Got it.
Hey everybody, this is Tom, and we're here again today with Eric Francis Cofolino. He was on a few weeks ago, and that sort of, if you want to go back to that interview, it sort of is kind of conceptually foundational to what we're going to be discussing today. Therein, we sort of scrutinize the spiritual dimensions of the digital. But really, I have been remiss because I didn't give Eric sort of the introduction that I should have in that interview. Let me do that right now because he's been around the block as an investigative reporter, photojournalist for somewhere around 2 score years, I think he was telling me. He started when he was merely 19, documenting the Love Canal, that tragedy in Western New York. And he's actually been talking about that on Let It Waves and Chiron Return more recently, in light of that tragedy. He did a lot more work subsequently on corporate fraud and associated lawsuits in Sierra, the New York Times, the holy goddamn New York Times, as they refer to it in Network, the Ecologist, the Village Voice, RIP, Woodstock Times, and lots of other fun jazz.
Few other
He
times.
is also the founder of Chiron Return, the nonprofit investigative team and mentorship. Well, he's got a mentorship program, and I am a potential candidate for aspiring journalist. Chiron is the publisher of Planet Waves FM. That's on Pacifica Radio. And really, I want to say historically, their importance will be more conspicuous because between 20 and 23, and as far as I know, you guys are the only organization that did this, certainly the organization that did this as deeply and as systematically. You have a 330-page blow-by-blow COVID chronology, which I would exhort people to go and investigate. About 15 people involved in that effort, and Eric was the coordinator. He is providing a real-world, real-time training program, which prepares journalists for many challenges. As I mentioned, I am a prospective candidate there. And by the way, before we started recording, we had all kinds of audio issues. And he was kind enough to je shepherd me through those embarrassing technical difficulties over the course of about 30 minutes. So, a testimony to his graciousness. In terms of formal areas of specialization, scientific fraud, mass poisoning incidents, toxic torts litigation. I thought it was interesting. I didn't know this, Eric. Public higher education law. That I found an interesting item. Medical and nursing education, civil rights law, and planetary astronomy. Under the pen name, the nom de plume of Eric Francis, he is also an astrologer renowned, and his columns have appeared, his horoscope columns have appeared in newspapers, magazines, and websites in the United Kingdom, Australia, North America, and parts of Asia since 1995. So I am graced to have a person with that kind of background here to have a conversation today. I don't know if you want to add to that, Eric, but what we're going to be
That
discussing
pretty much covers it.
is
I have a thing where I only have to sleep 5 minutes a day. So I
that's
effectively get an extra 30 years added onto my life.
that's enviable. That is enviable. I can't get by on like that. I need my sleep. There's a great line from Moby Dick: "The world is worth being born into just to fall asleep." And I'm definitely in the crosshairs of that quote. So it's hard to keep me from a nap. That being said, I'm an unrepentant night owl. So I like to sleep. I just like to sleep in the day. in my sarcophagus, so to speak.
But where did you get one on Amazon? They have.
I actually got it on eBay.
So. I bet they do.
I mean, what do they call them? Though you can, I actually, a friend actually looked it up and sent it to me on eBay. Sarcophagus, but one of the, I think they're called a palanquin. It's those things you'll see where they have four people holding up a throne or a little carriage, and you can get anything on eBay. You can get that and hire four people to walk you around the town. I think you could probably get a rickshaw. So, yeah. S. So, so to transition, and we sort of alluded to this on the previous interview. There is an archetype of the journalist that shows up in various quarters, sometimes in comic books, as this sort of hard-nosed individual who's going and scrapping about to get at the truth, who isn't imprisoned by an agenda. He's almost sort of exhibiting a commitment to a truer sense of what is a scientific method than many nominal scientists, right? And also this figure is also portrayed in that context anyway as having tension with the editor. There's always the editor and the journalist, and it's a little sort of theme which recurs in literature, especially comic book literature. But what's lamentable is that that ideal seems to have receded from the general consciousness, and the digital probably has a role to play in that recession, and this is a concern. And I think you have things to say about that concern, so maybe I can turn it over to you and ask about that.
Well, straight away, the tension with the editor is very important, because it implies that the person writing doesn't just get to push send. And the problem we have today is that everyone writing just gets to push send, pretty much. There's very little in the grand scheme of the internet. Very few places actually have editorial review. Now, some places do. Huffington Post has editors, and the major websites have editors. There's an editorial process. What that process has become is another matter, but that exists. But the overwhelming majority of writers not only don't have editors, they've never had an editor. There's no one reviewing their work before it gets out. I mean, really reviewing it. And then there's another problem where they've never been trained in the techniques you have to know to prepare a copy for your editor. So when you have an editor, if you're working as a reporter on a town newspaper or city newspaper or something like that, your copy has to be good enough to even get past the first stage. You have to have done all your work, and your editor is likely to guide you in that process. And the problem I have with most of the, for example, Substacks that come into my inbox is the writers look like they've never had an editor. They've never prepared copy for publication. And then there's this added problem of they've never actually faced the prospect of like losing their job for getting something wrong. They've never faced consequences or potential consequences for being wrong. And it's serious in journalism. If you've got a gig and then you either make a serious error or you're caught doing something unethical, you have a lot to lose. Jobs are hard to get. So this implies a structure, that journalism exists within a structure. It's not live journal, which is what it's basically become, or social media. Right? So the first definition is structure.
Perhaps say more about that, because really it surprises me the extent to which you sort of gravitated to how I noted that there's this tension between, you know, and from a literary standpoint, the editor and the journalist. Now, what also happens most of the time is that the editor is, there are exceptions, but broadly speaking, the editor is portrayed as a sort of wholesaled opponent. Now, like I said, there's and there are exceptions where at times the editor then suddenly exhibits in a quiet behind the scenes fashion actual advocacy on the behalf of the journalist. In Daredevil, the Netflix series Daredevil, that happened where there was a journalist and they were in tension with their editor, and the editor, even though the editor resisted the radicality of what the journalist was doing, they nonetheless, at the end of the day, stood on behalf of the journalist and even sacrificed themselves on that behalf. So it's interesting that the relationship between those terms is more nuanced than maybe one would anticipate at first blush. That may be deserving of further exploration and the connection of that relationship with the structure that you're mentioning. Mm-hmm. And it's really also a conversational structure, right? Because it's a dialogue. It's not a monologue. It's a dialogue. And the editor is actually helping the journalist dialogue more effectively with their audience. At least ideally, that's what's happening.
Well, there's standards that have to be met for something to be ready to go in the paper. I've had very few adversarial relationships with editors over the years. Normally you want to have a good, tight relationship with your editor, and that requires your editor trusting that you're doing a good job, doing the right thing. Your stories check out. Your stories have impact, and you kind of have a pure heart about it. I mean, that's part of the trust. There's no self-interest involved except getting the story right. Now, I have had tension with publishers where my editor has had to advocate for me. I mean, on one of my most important stories, a local story that became an international story, there was one paper in the chain that I started for. They didn't even want the story. They didn't want me working on that story out of that paper. So I was sent to a better paper, the Woodstock Times, where my editor was really interested in the story I was doing about some poison dormitories. And his boss was not into it that much, but he actively fought him, but he demanded his own autonomy because he had some power. I mean, the company has to run, and the publisher should give the editor in a group of papers or any paper, the publisher should give the editor a fair amount of leeway to do what they think is right. That's why they're the editor. The publisher is a businessman. The editor is a journalist. And so without that, I would not have done that story. And on the day that my editor, Parry, left, that was my last day, too. I never went back. I had no interest in going back. I had a relationship with my editor. On that same story, when I did it for Sierra Magazine, I worked hand in glove with my editor for 2 years. So we were in constant communication in the development of that story through 13 drafts. Because we had a lineup like a good shot in a pool game. I mean, there was no messing around there. But so your editor really is or should be your friend. But the point is that relationship for most people who put themselves out as journalists does not exist, and it never existed for them. And it's offensive. It's offensive to them that there would be some person with authority. I see it happening all the time, that somebody would be able to interfere with what I'm saying. Well, no, you want that. I welcome that. I want that. I make sure that my important paragraphs are reviewed by people. I have an interest in getting it right. I don't want to get it wrong. All you have is your reputation. So I own my own media outlets, right? I'm an independent station manager at Pacifica. I'm the publisher of Planet Waves. Even though I'm at kind of the top of this pyramidal structure, I make sure that I have people in my company who have their review role. My stuff is probably read by 5 people, and our company is at its smallest. 5 people read it before it goes out, at least. important paragraphs on the virus issue, they'll go right to Mark Bailey. I'll have Mark. Mark Bailey in particular. Maybe you've heard of him. Loves that I get the story right. So therefore, you find those people who love that you get it right. They'll help you get it right.
Well, in that connection, it's kind of an important. That might seem like a tangent to some people, but you brought up Mike Bailey. You'll have to remind me of her name because
Mark and Sam.
Not Mark and Sam, but what had happened or at one point in, I think this hit about a year and a half ago, I think it was early in 2022, there was an individual, I believe she's a Indian descent. I couldn't be certain. She was making the rounds as a dissident from the official narrative around the virus. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a sad situation because there are lots of things that she was saying that I liked what she was saying, but it turns out that it was she was prevaricating. And she was presenting things without actually having done her homework, and her own credentials were questionable, to put it diplomatically.
Well, I did that story. I mean, that was my story.
Yes, yes. And yeah. You brought that up. And you see, your commitment to a level of standard is what permitted that, because she was sufficiently sophisticated that if one didn't have an acquaintance with virological minutiae and the mechanics of the PCR issue and other relatively technical matters, one would likely have failed to notice the inconsistencies in what she was putting forth. And the problem with an individual like that is that they compromise the integrity of a dissident movement at large, because they're the kind of dissident to give dissidents a bad name. So I've raised the point to sort of buttress your point about the importance of standards, and here review is part of those standards, especially when it comes to nitty-gritty technical matters, because they may seem boring and tedious, but at the end of the day, they often are the levers which can be used to expose actual dishonesty.
Well, let's talk about that story. I mean, it's a fantastic case in point, and we should link to it. The story was called Charlatan's Web. And Wah had been around on the scene for a couple of years. I mean, that story, I broke that story in August of 22, a little more than a year ago. And I work closely with the doctors or the well-known doctors. I'm no longer in daily communication, but then for a long time was in daily communication with Bailey and principally Mark. Sam, you know, Mark is the research end of the project, and then Dr. Kaufman, Dr. Cowan. We were working with Kevin Corbett, a British PhD and expert in diagnostic testing, and a number of other people. Christine Massey was in this group. We were all the people who came out of the Virus Mania project in January, early 22, and she was able to get pretty far even with that group because they wanted to believe that there was someone who had run like 800 tests and couldn't find the virus in 800 tests. And Cindy and I, Cindy is my kind of research partner. So first of all, I'm blessed to have someone that I work with at times around the clock. I mean, we may take a little break between like 4 and 10 in the morning. Which it seems to be when she sleeps. But we watched this go by for more than a month as she was discussed by this no virus group. And then I started to pick up on her MO, and I listened to some interviews with her, and I was concerned that she was getting very basic things wrong. Like, she didn't know the titles of papers. She didn't understand the title of the retraction paper that came out in late 20. By 22 life scientists calling for the retraction of the Corman-Drosten paper. And she was sloppy on those kind of details. And I am trained by attorneys, and I'm trained to interview scientists. And what I'm listening for, and what I expect them to be listening for in me, is precision of fact and precision of language. And I heard her slipping and sliding, and not really staying in her lane. And then finally, what I did was I sent her kind of a, I noticed she was going from bigger podcast to bigger podcast. Right. And then she was even invited onto the Corona Investigative Committee by Reiner Fulmig. And I invited her onto the program. You have a flying object in the room.
Someone's running across the store. They're running hard. They're upstairs. Sorry.
So what I did was I saw her MO was to, she wanted to be famous. So I wrote her one of my official invitations on Pacifica Radio letterhead, which basically I represent a national radio network, and she jumped at it, and we set up what I told her was going to be a preliminary interview for a Friday afternoon, but I introduced myself as a journalist and recorded the interview. Now that's legit because I'm a journalist and I say that I'm a journalist, and you're either on the record or off the record with a journalist. I never went off the record. And so I basically did a pre-interview that was the interview that lasted about 45 minutes. And the question that did her in, which I want a Pulitzer nomination for this. I don't need to get the prize, but I just want the nomination, was I said, what was the title of your PhD thesis? Now, I ask this to people at parties. If I meet if I'm smoking a joint in the park and I have a PhD next to me, and I'm, hey, what was your PhD thesis title? A lot of them have it right in their iPad. The whole thesis. She couldn't tell me the name of the thesis. So then I'm like, but I'm playing it off, right? I'm keeping it friendly. I'm keeping going. Oh, okay. Well, what was the thesis of the thesis? No, there's nothing there. And then she just keeps on going and going. And so then I've got 45 minutes of tape. And that then from there ensued, like, you know, final assembly of the investigation. We had already checked all the academic databases in England. There's a procedure for where the PhD is supposed to go in the library. Wasn't there, wasn't listed. We went through, I mean, you really can't imagine how many steps we went through to get that story right, because I didn't really know who she was. She could have been some plant. You know, people throw around controlled opposition. I don't usually say that very often, but someone doing that kind of op where they are claiming to have run 800 or 500, whatever bullshit story she made up, tests and led the lab and led the study, and she, you know, talking about her PI or principal investigator on, you don't know who that is. So when you do that story, you only get one shot, and you aim. you aim. It is a kind of, I knew I would be taking her out in one shot. I've done this long enough that I know, even in the chaos of the internet, how this is done. And I knew the story would play large. And I was going to take a week and a half to do it. And Mark Bailey just wrote me an email. Well, we saw her appear on the Corona Investigative Committee on Sunday. I interviewed her Friday. And Mark sent me, Filmic invites her on. And Mark sends me a one-line note. Hey, maybe you want to pick up the pace of this a little bit. Like, yeah, that's a good idea. Don't need to say anymore. I had the piece out by 3 o'clock Tuesday morning. And by later that day, we had confirmed with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, no person by that name ever took a degree. Now, what was incredible was the reaction of the community around her, of people who had put her on the on their programs, not retracting it. She was absolutely exposed as a fraud. Some people continued to have her as a guest. Some had me on to basically explain what I had done, but I considered this as serious of a story as I've ever done, ever, really, including going after Monsanto or something like that. for the league that we were in that time. And my main, and then every time I got an occasion to be on someone's podcast to talk about that, because I got a lot of bites of the apple on that one. I said, we need standards and practices. Every podcast has to have standards and practices. Every blog, I call them blogs, now they're Substacks, has to have some standards and practices. There has to be a standard, an editorial policy. And of course, that's a great song to play, right? It sounds great, right? It makes me look fabulous. It sounds good. Everyone's like, that's right. But no one's really interested in doing that. So I understand the rhetorical value of what I'm doing, but I also have an editorial policy. And I think places should have an editorial policy and an editorial structure and a review policy. I mean, I have a mentor in Oregon who's in her 80s. And we've done this a lot of times, right? We worked together on the dioxin story covering Monsanto. And her group, for the 10 years before she met me, they were preparing litigation and journalism. So I learned from her to work to the standards of a judge and jury. So when you read anything that I've written, I am working to the standards of what would be acceptable before a judge and jury. That's a very high standard.
I recall one interview that you did, hearing it, that you, amongst the standards that you could enumerate, you have or had and have protocols for interaction with the guest, or in this case, the subject of the story, where you asked her for a preliminary interview, you presented yourself as a journalist. And then, as I recall, before you published the story, you gave her notice and an opportunity to address that.
Repeatedly. Yes.
Which is not a trivial point.
No, it's the fair play doctrine. It's called the fair play doctrine. Mm-hmm. That no story should surprise the subject. And the subject must be given the opportunity to give their best defense. And so I had the story done, was ready to go to press, and over a series of I think I did this Sunday, I did it Monday, and Monday night I gave her deadlines and said, and I knew how fast she answered her email. I said, we're going to press with a story that says you don't have any PhDs. This is your chance to defend yourself. I am following the fair play doctrine. My editorial policy says I must give you your best opportunity to give your best defense to the public before I go to press. This is that opportunity. And she did not respond to my emails.
So, and I mean, one can follow up and learn more about that story, and we'll link to it in the description. But something that occurs to me as you're speaking additionally is how there are journalistic protocols, and then there are also legal protocols, and there seems to be actually a relationship between those sets of standards. I don't know if you wish to sort of expound a little bit on the relationship between those terms.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, libel is something I take very seriously. And the thing with libel, I might have put my libel textbook in storage, but it's written by it's the benchmark, no pun intended, benchmark textbook written by a judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan, the court right below the Supreme Court. And it is very easy to not commit libel. You have to be able to establish what you say. You have to have evidence that you are playing fair, and that you have sources, and that you've checked, and then in the case that you verified it, and then in the case, and you have to be right. Right, you're only liable is only if you are not only wrong, but you are intentionally harming the person. It's an intentional tort. It's not an accident. Liable is not negligence. And therefore, it's easy to remedy. And in the case of a public figure or someone holding themselves out as a public figure, so that's kind of the standard, right? Is actual malice? You have to have actual malice, which means that you have to know that you are. It's an intentional act of harming the person. And I went through a phase in 2019 where I had to learn a lot about libel law because I was planning to bring an action against someone or investigating the possibility of doing so. And so I learned enough to know that you never want to sue somebody for libel. It's very hard to win, but it's also very hard to commit libel. And most people don't carry insurance. They don't have any concept of what it is. They do not apply the fair play doctrine. I think if you apply the fair play doctrine, you cannot be said to be committing libel. If you're giving people an opportunity to defend themselves, you're showing that you have commitment to the truth. Plain and simple.
Which is the other question in terms of the relationship between journalistic and legal standards, and that's the commitment to the truth, or if you don't want to go so far as to use the word truth, the commitment to facticity. And I'm pointing out that connection because I think it also comes back to the question of how has the digital affected the state of journalism? And one thing that you've already noted is that it's sort of collapsed the structure within which journalism has happened, where the practitioners have been collapsed from just being, so you could tease it out, there's the journalists, the editors, and the publishers, and now those are all three: judge, jury, and executioner, journalist, editor, and publisher.
One
collapsed
guy.
Into a single individual. And that collapse is problematic. I have ideas as to why that's problematic, but let me ask you about that collapse and also about, with respect to issues of facticity or truth, how has the digital affected those commitments as well? Those are two questions, I suppose.
Well, it's put everything through a blender. And I think the important thing to recognize is the environment's running the show. So the New York Times standards went down radically when it became a thing on the internet,
right next to Twitter.
And their editorial standards at times have gone seemingly below the level of Twitter when they weren't that good to begin with, but at least they had a pretext and balance. And every, My theory with the Times was that every desk has its own set of standards. You have to know every issue. So Metro is going to operate on one set of rules, National on another set of rules, Photo on another set of rules, and Sports on another set of rules, and so forth. But digital has made everything into a huge mashup. And it's our minds that are getting mashed up. There's not a thing getting mashed up. The thing is just overflowing out of our minds, and people's perceptions are changed, that things are not in hard black and white anymore. You can rewrite the story after it came out. I mean, the memory hole is right there. You know, in 1984, Winston has to cut the things out of the paper and drop them down the hole into the fire and then rewrite he takes pride in his work. He's really good at it. He forges a new article. He rewrites history. He's a good guy, right? But that's his job. And now you just go and edit the piece. You just go right in and edit it. So this is all very troubling. But I can't emphasize enough the importance of working within a structure. I mean, I think this has been one of the most dangerous things to happen. And it's not that the places that have structures are so good, because they too are affected by this and they're playing their own game. And that's another issue. You know, we would need to take it a case in point, a story that made it out that caused damage in some way, right? That would be an individual case. But in the broad case of all these Substackers, who no one even reads their piece before it goes out, where is the process of going through your journey from your theory to your final report? What does that process look like? There are journalists who know you cut your copy back and they've come through print. I mean, the people who have come through print are very different than the ones who didn't, and they're getting watered down in the process. I don't feel that I am. I mean, I have very, very high standards. because I that's just how I am. And I don't want anyone around me who doesn't have high standards. I want people around me I disagree with. I have the integrity to be disagreed with and still make my own decision. This is very time consuming when all you need to do is push people's buttons and you know that you get subscriptions on Substack. It's not the best stories that make the best business. Right? Pranima Wah got like 3 subscriptions, a lot of free subscriptions. But truth is not really a commodity in our culture. And this is, and by truth, I mean an orientation. I don't mean some honest, like ultimate truth. I mean just a kind of a guide that you use, a compass that points you north.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, publications go right for their agenda. They go right for their advertisers. They go right for their what's going to soup up the public and what's going to sell papers. And this yellow journalism mentality affects a great many Substacks. And when I get a Substack, you can always reply to the author, and I say, you know, you're writing this article as if you got ironclad proof that a virus exists. Show me the proof. What do you got? And people get very annoyed. They, you know, it's because it's considered some kind of a purist thing. I'm like, no, you know, we reported the mayor was shot on Monday. You can't have him giving a press conference on Wednesday.
Yeah.
The fuck? So, you know, you're correct that it's archetypal, but it's there's a real, archetypes are there as models for us. Right? They're there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know?
They address an aspect of human reality, which is being, in my view, corroded profoundly by the con. I had someone send me just yesterday. This might be a little offbeat, off topic, but not exactly. They sent me an AI it purported to be an AI generated monologue from Christopher Hitchens, if Christopher Hitchens had talked about McDonald's. I actually couldn't bring myself to listen to the whole thing, which was, I think, about 8 or 9 minutes. I listened to about 2 or 3 minutes, and it was coherent and it's enough, but and was vaguely sort of echoing Christopher Hitchens' style of presentation. But I was made physically nauseous by this piece, not because of its content, but because of what it represents, is this move to be contented with mere counterfeit, mere simulacrum,
yep,
that is not even generated by a human being, but by a program, by an algorithm. And the willingness to be content with that, as opposed to something grounded in the actuality of a person or the actuality of a circumstance, is highly distressing. I imagine for some people it's comforting, because then there is no standard. And with no standard, you have the impression of freedom, but it's not actual freedom.
No,
it's actually incredibly confining lassitude that will assure your bondage, your slavery. Mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah.
To put it frankly,
yeah. And we're swimming in it. We're swimming in it right now, as a culture, as a society, as a world.
And it sounds really annoying. Oh, well, where's the proof, you know? But then other things turn up, and like, I don't know if you want to talk about this or you have much of a position, but recently, for instance, on the question of climate change, there is a whole host of issues that beg factual scrutiny. And I start looking into the narrative around the significance of CO2 concentration, and I'm beginning to wonder if we're just not on the receiving end of an incredible snow job. Especially if you start putting the facts into like a geological context. Now that, of course, then you run into the problem of false dichotomies. And you say, if you start criticizing climate change, oh, well, you just want to poison the earth then, and you just want to, hang out with, DuPont executives or what have you. It's like, no, but you have to be grounded in reality, right? And to be grounded in reality, you have to be attentive to the facts, and the facts often don't fit well into a convenient package. I mean, I suppose I was indulging myself somewhat there in that discursus, but let me turn it back over to you and ask if it resonates with you in any way, and if there's any point in particular you'd like to bring up in response to that.
Well, it's a very important topic, obviously. And obviously there's weird things going on the planet. And I'm always checking when somebody says what the daily high was, I always check when the last time it was that high and all those things, just to spot check this. Let's see. The climate change issue, and by the way, it used to be called global warming, and then Frank Luntz rewrote it to climate change. Remember that? Luntz, the brilliant focus group guy who wrote a book that everyone should read called It's Not What You Say, It's What People Hear. And he explains how to write take anybody for a client, really, probably us if we pay him. And so there are so many viewpoints that are being thrown into the mix of this thing. But what I object to is that there are mandatory positions that must be taken. That you must believe a certain thing, whatever that thing is. And usually the thing that you must believe is not the thing that's true. The thing you're told you absolutely have to accept this as a fact before you've checked anything, but probably that's not the thing. And we're being told that thing is carbon. I love how they call it carbon and not carbon dioxide. They call it carbon. But I think there's that it's to say this is all by 100 years of emitting carbon through engines is a stretch. It's a very big ecosystem. And I think that there are very important questions that have to be asked, that if indeed there is a pattern of warming, why? That's journalism. You have to go right back to it and say why. You don't just jump right in and be like, oh, let's bash on carbon. Everyone else is doing it. Now it's time to bash on carbon. Why is that? But speaking of, gasoline engines, I learned recently about a very strong possibility that they were up to 1,000 miles a gallon in the 1970s. The 200, 100 piece of cake, and that they had developed technology to get the engines to run 1,000 miles on a gallon of gas. And obviously you can't have that because you're not going to sell very much of the stuff because nobody drives 1,000 miles very often. And no one's going to pay $100 a gallon of gas or more. So there's all kinds of evil coming out of the oil industry. To me, I believe it was Exxon in the 70s was investigating the possibility that burning fossil fuels was making the climate warmer. That to me is an important lead. That they stuffed that story. So really what we want to know is what the companies know. So much of my journalism career has involved extracted documents from companies. That's the litigation angle. What do they have in their files? What do they really know? We should know that. We should know that.
Which raises another issue, which is our willingness to cooperate with institutional confidentiality as something that is congenial. This is something which I've always found enigmatic, why people are okay with the extent to which things like the classification of information is considered adequate. To my view, it's actually wholesale illegitimate. I don't think the government has any authority to classify anything that it does.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah. Let's start there. Let's start with that as a starting point. Instead of everything secret, and then we'll give you this one. Well, in the for the they knew story from a couple of weeks ago that Daily Clout did. Oh, they sent back 46 pages of redacted emails, correspondence between Fauci and the White House and so forth. And then they gave him like this much at the end. And the whole story was based on that much, like two sentences where they admit knowledge of myocarditis and thrombosis. And that whole kerfuffle was based on two sentences or something, or one sentence out of 46 pages of redacted emails. Fucking crazy.
You know, people complaining about the 46 redacted pages. I mean, or the, I mean, this opens up like into the legitimacy of any so-called intelligence agency, CNA, CIA, NSA, all the rest of the alphabet soup. Okay. But also now we had this notion of corporate confidentiality. Again, to
oh, that's even worse.
Property there's issue.
That's even tighter.
And then this actually is why journalism and investigative journalism is important, because it's a hedge against these aspects of our culture that deserve to be undermined at a very fundamental level. It also connects to the issue of truth and facticity, and can you really have a commitment to truth and facticity, which can be reconciled with secrecy? What do you think about that?
There's tension between them. Generally speaking, the secrecy involves corporate profit, which often involves keeping secret the way that the process of making money kills people. And it involves warfare or anticipated warfare. So it's all about killing people. The secrets always involve killing people, and they almost always involve making money for killing people. The receptor, though, the people reading and listening, this is where the interesting part is, right? Because how do people respond when they find out some underlying level of reality? This is, I think, even more interesting than the facts that might come out, is how do people respond to those facts? Do they, when they're told that they're about to move their child into a dormitory contaminated with PCBs and dioxin, what do they do? And most don't do anything. Most don't. Can you hear me?
Yeah, no. I was about to say that what's amazing is that most people don't do anything. And we should ask, why is that? So that's one example. And then there are more sort of emotionally evocative examples, such as what happened on the 11th of September, 2001.
Yeah.
Okay. I am astounded by how we came to this piece independently. When it, the work of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, which I saw, I think, for the first time like 2005, or so several years after, post facto, right? I saw it after the fact, and it radicalized me with reference to that event, right? But I said, you gotta watch this. I made people watch it, and then they would remain indifferent.
Yeah.
Or they would, Or they would actively try and resist the conclusion. Like, oh, well, you know, it's like, it's math. It's math.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's intuitive also, right?
Or what has happened over the past 3 years, which is the word crime is inadequate.
Or
the violence done to our society by the events of the past 3 years, I think it would be difficult to exaggerate. But when you confront people with the evidence that they were assaulted by a digital pathogen, it's like they have an incapacity to assimilate what that means. So I feel that what we're confronted by at this moment is an incredible poverty of emotional capacity. People just, apparently have difficulty accessing their potential to hold reality, and can't blame people for, I don't know, maybe you, let me ask you, what do you think about that? I have my thoughts, obviously. I'm going to stop myself from going on.
You're talking about a really serious problem, I think, and this is the problem of ground, right? The investigative report, a 9/11 truth, that's the figure, right? That's presented to people. Then that lands on the ground somewhere, and then you have to look at why, what is in people, what is in that ground that makes them the way that they are. I mean, this is one reason why my career is a hybrid of a spiritual career as well as a journalistic career. I mean, as an astrologer, I am a kind of a minister. I'm speaking to people's most private spiritual needs, their fears, their guilt, their loneliness. So I work to one standard in everything that I do, but there's different surfaces. I'm kind of like a scrubby pad. I have the soft surface is the astrology, and then the gritty surface is the investigative reporting. It's the same sponge, basically the same soapy water. I'm very interested in people's most private responses to things. And you know, one, the genius of the AE 9/11 truth, I don't know if you caught my interview with Roland a couple of weeks ago. I mean, Roland and I do a really good job when we get into a conversation together, because we're speaking the same language, and I've checked all their work is based on capable of not being an engineer. But at the end of their documentary, they devote 15 minutes to psychologists talking about this problem of ground and why someone might not accept this. And that was obviously there as a kind of a window for people to have into their own possible resistance. But I had tremendous respect for it, for that. Not everyone's logical. I figured out 9/11 through studying one Department of Defense photo of the Pentagon. That's outside the purview of AE 9/11 truth. They don't touch the Pentagon. But I was told an airplane hit the Pentagon, and I downloaded a high resolution, you know, like 3,000-4,000 pixel picture, and I couldn't find an airplane in the picture. And it was liberating, but most people did not find that to be liberating. So that to do investigative reporting effectively is a lot of spiritual work you have to do to be able to hold yourself in the face of the unknown, in the face of what might be terrifying, in the face of active resistance from people, in the face of your own friends not talking to you. You know,
do you think there is a connection between a kind of a spiritual deficiency and the failure of mainstream or legacy, I don't even, I'm sorry I even said it, journalism.
No, no, I think you're onto something.
That neologism. But
what's the neologism? What's the neologism?
Legacy journalism, legacy media. It's but
look, the shift
because
is
it's trying to give dignity to something which doesn't deserve dignity. But anyway, go on.
Well, we're talking about the shift from print to electric. We're talking about ink and paper and its consciousness to electric consciousness. So one thing that I have is I'm a scribal type person, as you are a scribal type of person. I'm not an electric person. I do okay in electrical environments, but deep down, I love my books and I write in pencil and I would rather write than do video, but people like video and I've kind of taken to it myself, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm a scribal person. Now we have a lot of electric people transformed by electricity. Their consciousness has been pushed out of themselves. And one of the differences between an electrical environment, and this is a spiritual matter, between a scribal environment and an electrical environment is, in a scribal environment, I sit here and take notes for weeks about what I want these interviews to be. This is part of a series I'm doing. And I keep track of them and I clip them together and I rethink them and I add notes to it and I slowly develop my ideas and eventually I'll type it and I'll fill it in. That's not instant involvement. In an electrical environment, you're in. That's it. You're in. We could be live right now. There's no layering process in that. And so that instant involvement is doing things to people spiritually. There's no initiation to the process. You don't have to go, for example, in electrical media like Substack, you don't have to go through anything to get there. Anybody can just do it. Now, you might not have many readers, but you might. You might write one thing, it goes viral. So we need to at least recognize what a scribal reality is. The reality formed by books, which is deeply introspective. It takes time. There's a revisioning process. Look, I love digital photography. I mean, I'm obsessed by photography. It's a passion of mine. I'll photograph anything or anyone. But I'm so glad that I went through darkroom, that I had to spool my film off of the bulk reel and fill my little capsules of film and then go out and have a limit of 36 photos and then come in and have to learn. I learned how to develop film and then I learned how to print film and I went through and then I learned how to shoot stats, you know, to make it ready to go. And I would not be as good of a photographer as I am had I not been through all of that entry, all of that understanding the process from etching. Basically, it begins with etching acid on rock. I mean, chopping wood and putting ink on it. It starts with those technologies. So there's the instant involvement is really the thing I think that's shattering people. It's pulling them out of themselves, and everything is instantaneous. And then its meaning is reduced by that, and the idea of meaning is reduced by that. I think.
Yeah, it is. It's. I mean, to me, when you say it, it's just like, well, yeah, there you go, right? Like, who's gonna be like, no, all right? It's like, you know, like I'm more introspective because of social media.
No one's more introspective. Right. That's not that.
So
that never, ever happened.
Okay. It is fascinating how powerful though these media are. To like, I see it personally. If I turn on my phone and then I go Instagram, I'm like, what am I doing?
Trump. How does Donald Trump wind up in the White House? And now I don't think he should be being prosecuted 85 times, but look at what's spewing out of all this conduct. How did that person end up being president? The answer is digital. He has an electric personality. He worked it. He worked the polarization. He played everyone off of each other. And look what happened. That's power. That's power. I mean, sure, we get sucked into these things and all that stuff. And, you know, but man, to what happened to the world as a result of that? But it didn't come from him. That's the thing. And this is the thing that's so frustrating about all the people saying, well, you look, you know, I read the New York Times every day, at least to the point of scanning the entire front page, see what the viewpoints are. Trump this, Trump that. Oh, this bad person. No, it didn't come from him. It came from us. You know, as the Rolling Stones said, after, you know, who shot the Kennedys? After all, it was you and me. What he means is that came from the ground. It doesn't matter who pulled the trigger. It came from the ground.
So then we asked the question of like, well, what next, right? What is to be done? What is to be done?
Yeah.
And of course, one doesn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just go back to typewriters and mimeographs, as romantic as that may be.
I miss them so much. I had so much fun with typewriters and mimeographs. I tore it up, baby, with typewriters and mimeographs. Satires, all kinds. Pranks, fake programming, planning sheets, going into the pile of them in my school. I once put out one with like 100 copies. It wound up in university archives. They were that quick.
I just remember the purple ink. The purple ink of the
Rexo. That's Rexo. That's Rexo. It's a spirit copier. Right. You write on this. There would be an ink pad layer that would be purple. You'd write on your thing or type. You'd peel it up. The ink would be in reverse on the back. You'd roll it around the drum. The paper would get slipped into an alcohol bath on the way through and pick up a little bit of that ink. And then you had these kind of shitty copies. But my first satire was on Rexo, and I still have it. And it's still, you can still read it. It's from 1978, called Waterworks. It was a spoof on the feminist journal in my high school called Fireworks. I did one called Waterworks. Kind of an obvious.
You're always getting in trouble there.
About the first female garbage man. So I wrote, you know, meet Martha Smith, you know, the first female garbage man, you know, and a cardinal on the issue of abortion. I mean, it's a high school sophomore putting stuff out, and people loved it. But that was fun. The Rexo machine was in the office. I had free speech. I could type the thing or write it out, and I made it myself. And that's what we're doing now, in a way, but it's not Scribble, and it's high voltage, and we're all transformed.
This theme of a lack of discipline recurs. Yeah, I was watching, I know this is just, I like watching old police procedurals because they have a lot. It's just kind of nostalgia, which itself is a kind of danger.
What program? What's the program you like?
Oh, like Columbo and all these old 70s series. Right?
Adam 12? Columbo's probably 12 then?
What's that?
Adam 12.
Adam 12.
Adam 12.
I was watching Mannix last night. And
right,
he was using at the library the photostat machine, you know, and I'm sure you spend many hours going through all the newspapers with the microfiche. All right, so that's just romanticism, though, right?
But these things had impact, right? But the American Revolution was pamphlets. Pamphlets were very important, and posters were very important. So So today, everything's basically the bathroom wall. So my question, as a journalist, as a publisher who wants to kind of continue to be a straight shooter, is how do I do this? How do I do this? Who do I bring close to me? And we're all kind of scribal people in a way. I mean, we're all, you know, we all kind of seem a little bit 18th century in a way. You know,
I think that we can never escape our own corporeality. And this is the upper bound to which the electronic can subject us. We can be conditioned heavily in a way which I don't want to minimize, but we are still ultimately enfleshed beings. We're corporeal entities. We are immersed within a physical world, and that is part of who and what we are. And this is, to me, the source of hope. The body is an anchor which is going to pull us back to the incarnate in a way, in a fashion which I don't think that the electronic can undo, however vaunted the hopes of certain transhumanists may be. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, so my guiding philosopher through a lot of this is McLuhan, as you and probably everyone knows. And there's a disembodying effect that electrical technology has. And we're seeing it. I mean, the body is still the anchor, but not if people don't know and don't care. We're seeing it in the way people relate to each other. We're seeing it in the treatment of sex. I mean, for example, the whole idea that smiling at someone or being polite is in some way tantamount to rape is purely a digital effect. But people take this seriously. They think, oh, well, you looked at her. You thought she was beautiful. People could be offended. But this is purely a digital effect that you, anyone could even meekly think this. This is very bad for our relationships. And so our trust in existence is being worn down. Our trust in each other is being worn down. We have to monitor that in our own lives. And look, it's hard for a lot of people to trust anyone. And I know people trust me, and that's one of the reasons why I continue to, be so committed to the center of my work and to being available and, walking a very, very narrow path in life. I mean, I could be doing all kinds of things, but it's all about the cultivation of trust. And yeah.
And that is, I wonder if this is another digital issue. You say, like, you walk a particular path in life, which doesn't mean that you're, monotonous. Certainly you're multifaceted, but there's a focus.
Mm-hmm.
There is a commitment to a particular set of tasks that have a thematic unity.
Yeah.
The electric environment, does it undermine our capacity to exist in that way, to use religious language, to find and abide by a vocation? Or does it in fact give rise to a diffusion which obscures the discernment and commitment involved in enacting that discernment?
The second one is more likely. I mean, with all the options available, what to do and where to go is a very difficult issue for people, as is thinking anything is different than any other thing. This is really the most serious existential question. Well, I could do this or that. Well, why would I want to do one or the other? Well, how about, what you want? How about how you feel? How about what do you care about? Oh, but what if those things suddenly are themselves watered down? So as an astrologer, I depend on people being curious about themselves. I'm finding it harder and harder to approach people with that as my basic commodity, right? That's the hunger that makes people buy my pizza, is they're curious about themselves. There's something they care about in a way that can't quite put words to. Well, that's that, and particularly in the years since the 2020 crisis, has been heavily damaged. People's ability to be introspective, I think. And it's very, you know, look, we're scribal people. It's easy for us to cultivate trust. You know, some intuitive level that I care about you. So you can bank on that. I think you'd be perfectly shocked if I treated you in some way other than the way that I treat you. But a lot of people are not shocked by that. They just expect people to be completely flaky. That's a very serious loss to have. And look, people were not that good to begin with as a lot, you know, but it's getting harder and harder. You know, not having in-person contact. I meet a lot of people. I'll meet you the first chance I get. I don't even know where you are. I'll meet you the first chance I get. And I know that. I know that, right? But most of these relationships on the internet, they have no intention to meet, no sense of place in the relationship.
Yeah.
You know?
And I can only second all that. I'm in Cincinnati,
Ohio. You're not far away.
You know? But you see, even the fact that I'm willing to say that, like, you know, okay, here we are. Like, oh no, now the world knows that I'm in
Cincinnati. Oh, then I'm going to find you right away.
They're going to come with you. you know, that reminds me of two other things. Well, go on, you're going to say something.
No, I was the person that's finding you in Cincinnati knocking on the door.
Eric.
But why would someone worry? I don't give my address out, but I know anybody can find it. If you really look hard enough, you can find it. Right? I say what I live near. I describe the scene out my window. Okay, does anybody care that much? I put my phone numbers on the internet. You know, I insist on going against that. I insist on, if nothing else, for the fun of it. And I'd much rather publish photos of my community than of my tacos. You feel like,
yeah, I think
putting photos of their tacos, like, huh?
It's huge. This issue of trust is huge, because we're inculcated in this atmosphere of irrational phobia. It's irrational.
Yeah, absolutely psychotic.
Okay. The serial killer on the corner. the pedophile by the, I mean, everyone's a pedophile and a serial killer.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's disgusting. It's also incredibly untrue. All right. That doesn't mean there aren't serial killers and pedophiles, but when you look at what they represent statistically, you realize that it's irrational.
But it's in consciousness. It's in consciousness. It's in people's consciousness. So when I hear someone saying child sex trafficking, I think, what's your issue? Right? Someone goes on and on about child sex trafficking. Well, what's your issue? What's your issue? There's a lot of problems. Listen, I've counseled a lot of people who've been involved in bad scenes sexually, but it was never by a sex trafficker. It was always by some neighbor or their uncle or their older brother or their mother letting it happen. You think women are so innocent of this? Well, not exactly. It's almost all going on in the household. So I think the people who are talking about child sex trafficking don't want to talk about the household. Let's talk about the household. What the fuck's going on in the household? So there's corresponding personal issues to these things. And I think a lot of things are scrims, and a lot of things are like, you know, pearl clutching, and you're going to show how much you care. But how are you doing? You know, have you taken care of that thing that's been troubling you, whoever, for the last 35 years? And where do you even do that? Where you know, listen, I had a very good therapist. I learned a lot from this person, but I would sit in his room in his utter silence in his basement room in a suburban home in Woodstock, with a fireplace and you know, a chair and a couch, and we would talk in silence. No electronic devices in the room. And so that this is also crucial. I have to do my readings electronically these days. There's not enough people locally to make me available. And people, if somebody from England wants to talk to me, I'm going to be available. It's better in person, and I'm better because I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of readings in person and would be perfectly comfortable doing a psychic fair with a deck of tarot cards. So I think the intent to meet someone is a very important thing in the digital relationship. Do you ever see the South Park internet episode where the internet goes out and everyone's turned into a migrant and it's a spoof on the Grapes of Wrath, right in the middle of the internet going out? And Shelley, the teenager with the braces, who's Stan's older sister, she's a real psychotic 13-year-old girl. She's got this boyfriend on the internet. And she meets him in the camp, the internet camp.
Yeah.
You know, the camp in Weed and from the Grapes of Wrath. And she's not really interested in him. They're like, okay, see you later when we get back on the internet. This is largely the world that we're in. I mean, people are afraid to meet people off the internet. I have met so many people who I've met on the internet just because they're in town. Pretty much anybody calls me up and says, I your reader, meet me for coffee. There's very few people you can do that with. Try Rob Brezhne. Hey, Rob, I'm going to be in San Rafael. But you want to meet me for coffee? No, I write to writers down in the city. Daniel Pinchbeck. Like, you know, he's kind of a famous writer. I'm kind of a famous writer. I'm like, hey, Dan, I'll drive down to the city. Let's have dinner. Didn't even respond. I could invite them all. Now, eventually somebody will respond. It's not usually my colleagues. That was the fun of being in Thailand, by the way. I took this trip to Thailand, and somebody I was genuinely curious about, Dr. Kaufman, because I could never quite get his number, you know, can never quite figure. Right. And then we were put in the same in the same villa every night, hitting the bong until 2 o'clock in the morning. That was absolutely fucking fantastic. And I don't agree with him on like a million things, but it doesn't matter. He became my brother in that experience of sitting there every night, for like six nights. That's kind of a long time when you're in an environment like that. So look, that's another thing we can do. Like, meet the people, get on the phone, meet the people that you encounter on the internet. You don't worry about the Angie's List killer. Angie's List is probably gone, but I didn't do my Angie's List killer satire. You know, you hire the guy to like hang curtains, and they come and they measure and they make the curtains, and they hang the curtains, and then they kill you. The Angie's List killer. Right. You know, don't worry about the Angie's List killer. For fuck's sake, just go out for coffee.
That's what you gotta. I don't know. I don't know when this all started. It didn't start yesterday. It didn't start, like you said, it all comes back to the rise of digital media, and that this has been happening for decades. It's not what happened over the past 3 years had an abruptness to it, but nonetheless, the conditions of possibility.
Oh, it was the precipitation. Precipitation of something that had been building.
It's in the consciousness, the very fact that you have a cultural preoccupation with things like serial killing and so forth, right? And what's the obverse? And that was a very acute point, that in terms of sexual abuse, the vast preponderance of it arises in a domestic context. And so now we have to scrutinize the issue of the family, the atomic, the nuclear family, right? Which is another problem which attends to our society, is that we have reconceptualized the family in very narrow terms that will lead to spaces, repressed spaces in which bizarre and harmful behavior becomes possible in a way that it generally wouldn't be possible in other historical moments, which is not to romanticize other historical moments. Like, everything was hunky dory. There's always been crap going on, but it's a different kind of crap. And you know, there was a communal consciousness, which is double-edged, which has been blunted by the current circumstance. I mean, I am increasingly struck at how bizarrely my own views have been reoriented of late, because I am a person of, it's hard to get more radical than I am in terms of my political axioms as an anarchist of the hard left who wants to move beyond the structure of capital, blah, blah, cha, cha, right? You know, red as can be. And yet, coming out of this, I find myself suddenly seeing the significance of something like traditional familial orientation as bizarrely radical as a counterpoint to what's happening with proliferation of dependence on artificial frameworks that put us, they take us out of ourselves, and thank you for letting me go on, out of our own bodies. It's just an odd, it's an odd moment.
Well, it's on a completely new territory that we're in. This absolutely bizarre groundlessness that is, it's kind of a Bardo. I mean, we've kind of been thrust into Bardo. Between worlds, between lifetimes, out of body, but we don't know it. So the question is, how do you stay in? And the way you stay in is you stay creative and you stay loving and you don't cut off. That's you know, you keep making art. You keep being an artist. You keep at it. McLuhan says this, you keep finding this. You keep flip open a McLuhan book twice, you'll find it once. That the artist is the barometer. The artist is the edge of consciousness. The person willing to be anti-environment, to go against the environment, is the and that framework, that mental framework. And look at this stage, journalism is the anti-environment, right? True journalism is anti-environment in this environment of complete toxic intellectual anarchy and self-serving horseshit. True journalism, which should never be about you, right? The person writing journalism should almost always be about something else. It's not autobiography. This is dharmic. It's going to help stitch things together. It's going to help hold the world together.
Yeah.
It's getting a little late for me.
That's probably a good point in which to sort of round things out, is the fundamentally selfless character of journalistic enterprise as a countercultural moment. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's fine. No, that's fine. I had my initial here in my little stack of my scrolls. One of them begins with, you know, journalism is not about you. You're telling the story of the world in some way. You're talking about you're telling the story of the world. That's what journalism is. In some small facet, story of the world. You might be there. You might be in the story, but the story is the story of the world. And you have to love the world to do it, fucked up as it is.
Right. Love people, love the world.
Best you can.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Thomas.
We're there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Yep.
You have a lovely evening in the meantime. And thank you all for listening. I hope you have you guys out there enjoy the conversation. So,
bye
for now.